Our last speaker is as it has been alluded to already here, that this has been implemented in other countries. So we thought we would get somebody from another country, and we have Dr. David Urbeck, who's the professor of surgery and the surgeon in chief at the Women's College Hospital in Toronto, Canada. Dr. Urbeck.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation. So I don't have any disclosures that are relevant to the talk. I want to touch on four things. I was asked to talk about regionalization of care in other countries. Does it work? The first thing to discuss is what exactly do we mean when we say does it work? Because that could mean a variety of different things, as I'll describe. I do want to say why this is actually a reasonable question to ask, that I don't think it's at all certain that active regionalization programs are going to cause their intended effects. I'm going to say something very quickly about international health systems, and then I will tell a brief story about an active regionalization policy that was implemented around lung cancer surgery in a province in Canada, in Ontario. So the first question is, well, what is the question? Does regionalization work? And these are the types of questions that might come to mind. For example, does the decision to implement a policy to regionalize care, does that actually lead to regionalization? Do hospitals and surgeons and referring physicians follow through? There's another question, well, does that active regionalization in turn lead to better outcomes? And if it does, well, which outcomes are we talking about? We've heard a lot about short-term outcomes like mortality, which has a lot to do with failure to rescue, inability to save patients who have surgical complications. But obviously, this is a talk about cancer surgery. Are we talking about cancer-related outcomes, long-term survival, disease control, other clinical outcomes? There's economic outcomes. And we've had some discussion about patient experience. So there's a lot to unpack in the question of does it work? One thing I will acknowledge, and we've already seen a lot of this data, there is no doubt that volume is associated with outcome. High volume, better outcome. The problem is virtually every single study that demonstrates this, and there are tons, there's hundreds, probably thousands of studies now, are almost all of them are cross-sectional. So hospitals that are high volume have better outcomes, low volume have poorer outcomes. And cross-sectional studies in and of themselves can't really provide evidence of causation. Clearly there's an association, but an association is sort of like saying that coffee drinking causes lung cancer because people with lung cancer are more likely to be coffee drinkers than people without lung cancer. Whereas there's no biological mechanism that coffee drinking causes lung cancer. It has to do with the fact that smokers are more likely to drink coffee and smoking causes lung cancer. So disentangling association from causation is a problem. But the question I want to focus on here is, does an active effort to increase regionalization, does that lead to the expected improvement in outcomes? So there's a lot of methodological issues, and really the best way to address this type of study, the methodological approach that shows that something is causative, is an experiment, like a clinical trial, a controlled trial of some sort. But clearly that's very difficult to do when we're talking about large geographic policies like regionalizing systems of care. Ultimately, what we're probably best left with are longitudinal studies that look at what happens over time within the same hospital, so you can study it very clearly. And I'll give you an example of that type of study design, which is an interrupted time series design. But there are these problems. There's confounding. You know, is it the smoking? Is it the coffee drinking that ends up causing the problem? And there's also the problem of secular trends. As you've seen already in data, things are just getting better all the time. Anyone who's done research with large population-based data sets, the most striking thing is everything gets better over time. Mortality goes down year by year, actually month by month if you have large enough sample sizes. And on the right is just an example of why this is problematic. This is a study from a Dutch, from Netherlands, after they implemented a regionalization policy. And what you can see in the histogram, the black part of the histogram are the proportion of patients having pancreatic surgery in high-volume hospitals. And then the pink bar shows mortality. And what happens over time is more patients have surgery in high-volume hospitals, mortality goes down. But it still doesn't tell you that the change in the patients having surgery in high-volume hospitals causes the change in mortality. So 30 seconds on international health systems. There, obviously, the U.S. is just one health system. One thing to remember about health systems is that there is no good health system. Everybody hates their health system for various reasons. None of them were designed intentionally. They all kind of occurred by happenstance. There's a lot of variation primarily in the financing and delivery of care. So financing can be public or private. Delivery can be public, like the VA system or like the NHS in England, or it can be private. And if it's private, it can be not-for-profit or for-profit. In Canada, delivery is private, not-for-profit. In a lot of American hospitals, they can be private, not-for-profit, or private for-profit. Ultimately, funding drives behavior. If you want to understand how anything works, you just have to follow the path of a dollar through the system. And ultimately, all systems are resistant to change because of what made them unique systems in the first place. There's lots of rankings of different international health systems. You know, we in Canada love this. This is the Commonwealth Fund that ranks a lot of Western health systems, and we turn around and that's the U.S. Over on the far right, which is actually the worst performing health system. I don't know if Americans realize this, but in international comparisons, the U.S. health system does not fare very well. So we chuckle and we high five, and then we toast ourselves with Bloody Caesars and Tim Hortons coffee, and we eat butter tarts and coffee crisp bars until we realize that Canada is like almost as bad as the United States. So when you look, well, what is a high-performing system? The UK is actually the highest performing healthcare system, given everything we know about the NHS and all the... very illuminating if you look at international comparisons. I wanted to have just one slide that just ranked all the different healthcare systems with a very brief chart about how they're the same and how they're different. But again, from the Commonwealth Fund, there's so many different attributes of these health systems that it's really impossible to kind of summarize it in a single slide. But there are a variety of different international health systems. Dr. Wong already presented this very interesting large discussion paper from the European Surgical Association looking at centralization of surgery internationally. These are all the different countries in Europe, as well as Canada and the United States on the bottom, showing which countries actually have established volume thresholds for complex gastrointestinal surgery. And in fact, there's six of them highlighted here that actually have a legally enforced standard. If you actually read the paper, they will say that even though these countries have a legally enforced standard, it's not really enforced. It's very difficult to enforce these things. But there's not a lot of research about what happens when you actually come up with a legal policy to create regionalization where there wasn't an intent to regionalize in advance. So the last thing I'm going to talk about is the story of what happened to lung cancer surgery in Ontario, Canada. So Ontario is a province in Canada. It has a population of 13 million people. And it looks like, I wonder if there's a pointer. Yeah, there you go. That's Ontario. And in 2007, the province implemented a policy that regionalized lung cancer surgery only at certain hospitals that they called designated hospitals. So whenever you see DH in the following slides, it's designated hospitals. So this was a real policy. If you don't believe me, this is a picture of the actual policy. So it's an absolute fact. And it was enforced with financial incentives and penalties. So this was a real thing. And what we decided to do is assess multiple outcomes. We wanted to see how effective this policy was, what effect it had on clinical outcomes, what impact it had on the distance that patients were traveling to hospitals in the province. And we used a longitudinal design called an interrupted time series analysis. And I'll show you what that means shortly. But we decided we had to do that because you couldn't just look at before and after. So people did look before and after what happened in Ontario, and you know what happens over time if you compare to like how much lung cancer surgery was done in designated hospitals compared to the pre-regionalization. Every year, more and more patients had their surgery in these designated hospitals. So we knew this was happening naturally, as you've seen, this happens all the time. And then what happens with mortality? Well, if you look before and after, it wasn't a huge difference in mortality after lobectomy, but after pneumonectomy, it seemed like there was a huge difference. Is this an effect? Is this caused by regionalization? This sort of study can't really tell you that because, again, it can't disentangle association from causation. So what we did is an interrupted time series, and I'll just walk you through this slide because all the other slides are basically the same sort of slide, where there's a break in the figure. That's when the policy was implemented. So it was after 2007. So this is before the policy took effect, and this period is after the policy took effect. What this slide is showing is the proportion of lung resections done in designated hospitals. So this is like 0%, 100%. And each dot is the adjusted proportion in each quarter of the year that was done in a designated hospital. So then we just drew this regression line, and these are confidence intervals. And what this dotted line is, this is just the projected of what the future state would have been if there was no change. So this is equivalent to the time trend, and then this is empirically what happened. So this absolutely is true, and you could also sort of see it on the previous graph, but every year a higher proportion of patients ended up having their surgery in designated hospitals. Interestingly, in Ontario, 70% had their surgery in designated hospitals even before anyone put any policy into place. So you see a lot of de facto natural regionalization. But we got close to 100% by the end of this study period. So this is a strong effect, both immediate and over the long term. So one thing we could conclude is, yes, a policy did seem to make a difference in the extent of regionalization or centralization of surgery. Well, what about mortality? Because we've heard a lot about mortality. That other cross-sectional study I showed you showed that, in fact, mortality overall was better in the period of time after regionalization than before regionalization. And if you look at the exact same type of figure, this is, again, death in hospital after surgery. So this is like 1%, 2%, 3%. On average, it was about 4% in the period before. It went down to about 3% after. So there's about a 25% reduction in mortality. But if you look at the secular trend, and these are the actual, the blue dots are just the quarterly estimates, it basically is all attributable to what looks like a pre-existing time trend. So beyond the secular trend, it doesn't look like there was an independent effect of regionalization. That it's true, mortality went down, but it seemed to be going down anyways. Would it have gone down by the same extent? We don't really know. But we didn't find any evidence that the interrupted effect of implementing this policy suddenly made a change in operative mortality. Well, what about everything else? Complications, similar story to mortality. The curve after the implementation of the policy was pretty much the same, basically the same for reoperations. Maybe I'll test you here. So length of stay. Anybody know what's the story here? Did the policy have an effect? Yes, okay. So yes, so this is the projection. So and it's outside the confidence interval. So there did seem to be over time a gradual decrease in length of stay that we could not explain based on a secular trend, which didn't appear to exist before the policy was implemented. And as far as readmissions, again, we didn't really find much of a statistical change. So we've heard a little bit about the patient experience. Do people have to travel farther, and what's the effect? We actually found a very marginal effect at all on distance traveled. It looks like there was a kind of a trend towards a slight increase in distance traveled. It wasn't statistically significant. And if you remember back to the first slide, part of the problem was lung cancer surgery was largely regionalized at the outset of the study. So it's not realistic that we would have change the path of travel for that many people seeking surgery. And then finally, what about cancer-related decision-making? Does this change the probability that a patient undergoes resection? Maybe there's changes in neoadjuvant treatment or decision-making or anything like that. So, you can argue that this is a statistical change at the very end of the period, but really it's not a huge difference in terms of the proportion of patients who ended up with resection based on all newly diagnosed patients with lung cancer. Somewhere between 15 and 20% had resection before and after the implementation of this policy. So just to circle back to the question asked in the beginning, does it work? Yes and no. We found that in a system like Canada, lung cancer surgery was already largely centralized even before the implementation of a policy. What causes this? presumably it's some health system factor. Canada has a system of public payment for all these health services with private not-for-profit delivery, and maybe that's a system that's more predisposed to this natural regionalization. But we did find that a policy actually did lead to even further centralization of care. So it does seem that implementing this as a mandate can affect change. We did not see the expected changes in clinical outcomes beyond what would be expected based on the existing time trend, with the caveat of a slight reduction in length of stay. What are the implications for international health systems? One thing I would say, and I will give the caveat that there aren't too many studies that actually look at cause-effect relationships with planned active regionalization, but I will say that it's not necessarily obvious that centralization, active centralization, will always lead to the intended clinical benefits that you see in the cross-sectional volume outcome studies. And ultimately, I would say that effectiveness of these policies are going to depend a lot on the nature of the health system, in particular, how services are financed, how they're delivered, and ultimately the role of central coordination and how amenable they are to changes in the organization of the health system. Thanks very much.
Well, in advance, I'd like to thank our four speakers for four just really great talks on this topic. We'll open up to any questions that anyone has. If not, I'll start. I have a couple of questions. So, in the context of the U.S. healthcare system, dysfunctional though it may be, with all its fleas and faults, so is it best for us to continue to try and bring Moses to the mountain or mountain to Moses, right? So should we keep trying to look for efforts to bring patients to the centers, or should we be looking for more broad-based quality efforts, better definition of what the structural and the process level factors are at these high-performing, high-volume centers that could be implemented more broadly at more slightly lower volume community hospitals? What's the best approach? How do we improve what we're doing?
So I think the fair answer is it has to be both. I don't think there would be much disagreement that if you do one pancreatectomy every other year, you probably shouldn't be doing them. And I dare say that most hospitals don't want to be in the habit of having a surgeon do a pancreatectomy every other year. And I think increasingly, I think care has gotten better, but if you look at those numbers, there's a 12% difference in the chance of making it out of the hospital or living 30 days. That's pretty hard to get over. So I think for certain cases, it's unequivocal, and I think that people are doing it anyway. I think the data would suggest that everybody's kind of paying attention to this, and I think people are limiting their practices appropriately. I think that for certain other types of cases, like the much more common things, like breast surgery, I think you just have to take a look at it. I work in a rural academic medical center, so we see this a lot, is that, sure, you can take care of most breast cancer locally, but I think the problem that we see a lot is that if you actually want reconstructive services to go with that breast surgery, you have to kind of travel for that care, because a lot of our smaller hospitals in our catchment area don't have plastic surgeons on staff. So I think it takes a little bit of a personalized approach. I do think that we have to be responsible for policing ourselves. I do think we have to work together and collaboratively so that if a readmission is a possibility, that we have a coordinated system to take care of that. I talk a lot with our oncologists, and I think that a lot of patients don't mind traveling for their operation. They'd like to stay at home for their chemo and for their radiation. And so that takes a lot of coordination. It takes a lot of trust in the system to make that happen. So I think it's both.
I guess I would just say exactly what she said, that we do send lungs and pancreases out, obviously. But we also have a full-service radiation and chemotherapy service. It's a small town, but we've been COC accredited for 30 years. We're NAPBC accredited for a small town. We still feel like we should do quality work. But many times when they go to the tertiary center, it's like they never come back. It's a black hole. Chemotherapy and particularly radiation is very profitable to a hospital, and those are services that we would like to bring back to our facility if we can do it as well as they can do it in the big center. And many, many times it doesn't happen, and I think the word collaboration that Sandra mentioned is key, knowing where you're sending them and knowing who's sending them and whether they can bring them back when they're done with the big stuff.
Let me just make one comment. I think our recent emphasis in quality in surgery and medicine in general, ever since the IOM reports and so forth, have almost in many cases have resolved this question. There's very few people in smaller community hospitals that want to do big complex operations just because they don't have the facilities to take care of them. They don't have the facilities to take care of the complications, which actually is probably the most important thing. The real question and the concern has been, how far do we go with regionalization? I mean, I think when Birkmeyer put out the data on esophagus and pancreas, and I don't think there was a lot of people in smaller hospitals that were real concerned about that, because in most cases they weren't doing those. When somebody started saying, well, colectomies should all be done in a regional center, I think then the concern and everything got a lot more complicated. So from the standpoint of doing complicated things in smaller hospitals, I mean, in North Dakota, we're in Fargo, and that's the biggest city and the tertiary referral center for the state. It's amazing the stuff that people don't want to do in smaller hospitals. I mean, and they refer that in, and we happily accept that. But I think a lot of those people have come to the conclusion they would rather not deal with those kind of things in the smaller hospitals. So, go ahead.
My name's Tom Visser. I'm from Grand Rapids in Holland, Michigan, Spectrum Health. I've seen a lot of change in the last 15 or 20 years as healthcare has gone along. We've gone from small community hospitals having, under financial pressure, becoming part of a larger system. Larger systems now have to deal with the hub and spoke model and everything coming to them. And what we dealt with in our system is that when everything started going downtown, we found out that stuff there actually had worse outcomes for SSI, cost of care, length of stay. And a lot of that stuff was better done at the smaller hospitals. And so what we worked, and this is more of a statement, not so much a question, but more of a statement, what we worked for is figuring out a way to make the smaller hospitals better rather than bringing, when we talked about regionalization of care, we talked about how to bring the bigger center quality as far as outcomes to the smaller hospitals. We have digitalized MSTs, where we have virtual clinics where we can get, when we don't have enough of a specific expert, they can virtually put themselves up on a screen in front of patients. We have a standard tumor board that everybody who does a procedure needs to present their tumors to that tumor board. The cases and qualities tracked, and what we found out is the community hospitals can actually do it safely. We don't do pancreas. We don't do lungs at the smaller hospitals. We don't do esophagus at the smaller hospitals. We don't do big hepatobiliary stuff. But colon, breast, and stuff like that, we find that smaller hospitals are just as quality if you put them through the same things that have evolved over the time of the study, MSTs, multi-specialty tumor conferences, and everything else that are much easier to present at a regional center than they are at a smaller community hospital, and that standardizes cares, and that will help outcomes. So maybe the goal of this shouldn't be what should we bring to larger centers, but how can we bring the larger center to the smaller hospital?
I just want to mention that the regionalization within the VA that was sort of a de facto happened after the Marion debacle, was a top-down approach and was imposed within the VA system. And actually, it worked quite well, but it came at a very high cost, extremely high cost. I mean, for those 20% of patients that are going to the community, we're paying every year close to $2.5 billion to send them out. And how is this affecting the education of the residents and medical students in those smaller facilities that are intermediate or standard? And I think this is very important to keep in mind. Now the VA can afford it. The government is paying for it. The main goal, again, is safety and quality. And we achieved it. But it is coming at a very high cost. And we don't always measure the impact of cost when we, you know, when we regionalize care within within the community, you know, outside of government. We also are not measuring the impact on patients and families, and you know, having to go elsewhere. You know, in the VA, if they come to Boston, we offer them lodging at the expense of the VA. We offer them, you know, free meals. We offer them transportation, but this does not happen outside the VA.
So, you know, I'll dovetail your comments, Dr. Itani, with a question for you and Dr. Urbach, which is to say, you know, so is the VA model in any way translatable to the private sector? And then for Dr. Urbach, you know, I mean, if the data, certainly from Canada and I think some other countries, suggest that regionalization in perhaps less monolithic health systems, for lack of a better way of putting it, that may be more amenable to change and transformational changes on a system level, doesn't really work. Is there any way we can expect it to work here in our cumbersome health system?
So, you know, again, it was a top-down approach within the VA system. And I think there are some very good things that came out of it. But is it going to happen in the private sector? I sincerely doubt. But I think some parts of it can be taken to the private sector and instituted within the private sector. You know, why should you be doing esophagectomies or pancreatic duodenectomies in every single hospital in the United States? Should you be having an MRI in every single hospital in the United States? I think this is what's driving cost, and there should be some regionalization, but I think we have to be very careful about how far we drive that regionalization. It is very important for the community surgeon to continue to be able to have the variety of cases and to be able to take care of the patients who presents at night, on the weekends, with complex issues. You're not going to be able to ship every single acute surgery outside of the rural community center.
So as far as the ability to enact sort of large-scale regionalization in the U.S., you know, I think the lessons from international systems are that the degree of central coordination is very important. So the role of governments and the role of other bodies that actually have authority over the delivery of health services is going to be influential. So, you know, you can organize things well in a province in Canada, probably across the VA system. You could do it in the NHS. It would be very difficult in private hospitals. Although the interesting thing, and Dr. Wong talked about the volume pledge, which was sort of an interesting approach to regionalization because it didn't really, it was kind of agnostic as to what happens out there. It just sort of was a pledge about these large multi-institution corporate health systems and basically said, well, you know, we're a large health system. We have like X number of hospitals. Let's just make sure that if we're going to do pancreatectomies in our hospitals, it's all going to be done in a high-volume hospital in our system. So we're not going to do it at, like, five or six hospitals that have three of them have a low volume, but we're all within our system will make a pledge to ensure that there's no low-volume hospitals. So I think the opportunities to implement centralization of care all relate to the extent of central coordination, and that works very well in areas where there's like a strong government influence, but it doesn't work as well in the private, particularly for-profit sector.
So, you know, it's interesting that you mention that in that way. One of the things that the volume pledge, I think, presupposes is that every health system has within it a high-volume hospital that can provide that meets the benchmark, which may not necessarily be the case, right? I work in the Texas Medical Center, which is a city of hospitals, right? There are only so many cases to go around, and, you know, for patients, they also have to consider which hospital do I have healthcare coverage for, right? So how do we mitigate that? How do we, overcome patients' desire for care close to home, like the Finlayson data showed? And, you know, how do we overcome the associated costs for travel that are oftentimes, I think, not really taken into account?
So those are all very legitimate points. I think the pledge is what it is. I think it's instead of being very top-down, like the example with the VA, this is really a bottom-up approach. This is about accountability at the surgeon and hospital level. And, those numbers were really tough. I have to say, when we rolled out some of the numbers, not necessarily for cancer surgery, but when we rolled out the numbers for some of the cardiovascular cases, there were a couple of surgeons who were like one shy. And it was really a question of, you know, how arbitrary are the numbers? You know, how much variation do you tolerate year to year, kind of quarter to quarter? But at the heart of it, I don't know that it's necessarily about a number. You know, like if you are missing a case for a calendar year, but you have a case booked in 2 weeks' time, I mean, you know, are we really splitting hairs there? I think what the basic underpinning of the pledge is the ability to help people through that. You know, okay, so you took a sabbatical, you've been away, you know, for whatever reason, you broke your arm, you couldn't operate for a while. You know, how do you get back up to speed? If somebody took an administrative job, these are real examples, right? Somebody took an administrative job, they decided they want to come back to practice. Do we have proctoring programs in place? If somebody has a string of outcomes, you know, how do we help them through that? You want to pick up how to do robotic esophagectomy? You know, how do we proctor people through that? So I think this is really about ownership of this. And I really think if we don't do it, somebody will do it for us. And when I say somebody will do it for us, I mean some payer, some government agency, somebody will do it for us. And I think it's really important, not necessarily the raw numbers, kind of the rules around it, but just the ability to own this and to really own the accountability for providing absolutely high quality care. And since this is specific to surgical oncology, it really is about the entire kind of gamut of care from diagnosis through survivorship. And I think we really need to, surgeons need to own that.
Anybody else have any comments or questions for the panel? All right. Nathan?
Happy meeting. Thank you to the panelists. Thanks, everyone, for attending.